All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome. So let's begin with our meditations. We do about 40 minutes, a little bit of guidance to get us started, and then I'll jump into a short talk, and then we'll have a chance for some small group discussion around this topic of wise action. A poem by Kabir. Friend, please tell me what I can do about this world I hold on to and keep spinning out. I gave up sewn clothes and wore a robe, but I noticed one day the cloth was well woven. So I bought some burlap, but I still threw it elegantly over my left shoulder. I pull back my sexual longings, and now I discover that I'm angry a lot. I gave up rage, and now I notice that I am greedy all day. I worked hard at dissolving the greed, and now I am proud of myself. When the mind wants to break its link with the world, it still holds on to one thing. Kabir says, "Listen, my friend, there are very few that find the path." From the Kabir book, 44 of the Static Poems of Kabir. All right, thank you for sharing this practice with us. So I want to offer a short talk on wise action, a sort of recap from last week, and then we'll take a break and have a chance for you to stretch, go to the bathroom, and then we'll come back and have some small group discussions around this important topic. So wise action is really sandwiched in the middle of the Eightfold Path. So you got wise view, wise intention on one side, kind of the wisdom aspects. On the other side, we have the mindfulness, the concentration, the wise effort, the cultivation aspects. So in between these two, we have this middle section of wise action, wise speech, and wise livelihood. Really a focus and emphasis on sila, on ethical behavior. So that message in itself, the way it's framed that way, helps us use not as just, okay, I'm supposed to be ethical, I'm supposed to do the right thing. Sometimes that's a force of will that Kabir was talking about, that it just kind of comes out different directions. We try to stop this one thing, and it comes out in a sideways, in a different direction. But if you use wisdom to understand the nature of ethics and really what harm they cause ourselves and others, that's a very different support for them. And remember, Eightfold Path is really part of this whole Four Noble Truths that we've been exploring this whole year. So understanding in a deep way the origin, that there is dukkha, there's an origin of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, and then the Eightfold Path is the Fourth Noble Truth. So looking at that whole context, how it's all framed together, it's really about learning how to release suffering in a deep way, right? To release this optional suffering that we cause ourselves. And our actions can be tremendous ways that we either create joy and happiness and ease in our lives, or we can create tremendous suffering for ourselves and others. Right? So just framing it in that way, that it's not about trying to be the right, do the right thing, although sometimes that's better than not. But having this background of wisdom that comes in to support it. And then the mindfulness quality, the mindfulness factors and the concentration factors and the wise effort, the last three links of the Eightfold Noble Path, they give us the tools to actually see for ourselves, to actually see directly what goes on in this mind and body, what goes on in my intentionality before I act in a certain way. What does it feel like when I act in a way that's based in generosity, in kindness, and non-harm? How does that resonate in the body? How does the mind take shape around that? And then also the other side of it, when we start to maybe lean into against these precepts or these ethical trainings, when we lead toward with greed or lust or a sense of anger and hatred or a sense of lack, you know, those kind of things are our relationship to the truth. All these things, there's a different resonance that comes into our mind and body. As practitioners of mindfulness, of the meditation practices we cultivate, you can see for yourself very directly what arises in that. And the more clearly you see it, that becomes another guide that helps us see and more, keep more and more on the path. So there's kind of three areas that's often talked about in this wise action. Okay, so remember last month we talked about wise speech. So all the forms of communication around truthfulness, around timing, around appropriateness of that heart, you know, all those different qualities of speech that we explored that has its own path factor. Then wise livelihood we'll explore next month in September. But wise action, this kind of middle fold, has three aspects. So one is around non-killing. So non-killing, not taking life. The other one is around not stealing. And the third one is around how we use our sexual energy in a way that doesn't cause harm. You know, in a way that kind of keeps ourselves and others safe. So let's just talk about those briefly and then kind of go a little bit more how to work with these as they come in, up in our lives. So the first one, the non-killing. So non-killing is I think a lot of us hold that just as a baseline, at least for certain categories of beings, right? But perhaps insects, mosquitoes, bugs, we kind of, you know, disregard those. So there can be an invitation to become more sensitive and aware around those critters, our actions upon them. And realizing that, yeah, sometimes we don't have a choice. If we have a pest or something that's attacking us, maybe we have to take care of ourselves, but see if we can work with it. See if there's other options. And if we do have to take life in that way, you know, being very conscious and aware of that. Of course, this one precept, I kind of skipped this issue last week, but we can talk about pro-life and pro-choice. We can talk about all that whole arena around it. I often like to look at this particular one in terms of non-harm, right? So sometimes there's a choice of which is the less harm, you know, and personally, I think I really feel it's the choice of women and what they do with their body. You know, I'm very positive in that way of that pro-choice. But to realize, yeah, sometimes this is what needs to happen. But to realize that maybe it's not the first choice, not the first thing that we do, and maybe we practice with it. Remembering our precepts that we take on retreats or at the beginning of the year and different times in the calendar here, it's phrased as undertaking the training to refrain from. To undertake the training to refrain from. So IMS, Insight Meditation Society, apparently, at one point, they had an issue with cockroaches, right? So they were trying to get rid of the cockroaches, but trying to follow this ethical training. So apparently, they thought about hiring like a cockroach whisperer to come in and kind of whisper the cockroaches away, but they realized, we're spiritual, we can talk to our own cockroaches. And so I think they probably eventually had to do more of the traditional way of getting rid of cockroaches. But the point of it is that they practiced with it. They said, is there a way that I can work with this to not take life just without any regard? To hold it as, okay, what other options are there in relationship to this precept? The next precept is around non-stealing. Now, each of these precepts or this wise action, we could also frame it in the positive. So non-stealing, we can frame it as generosity. How can I come from a place of generosity, of my time, of my means, of my energy? How can I take into account all of those around me, both my close family, my city, my country, my world? How can I look at my actions and how they affect future generations? You know, I always appreciate the Native Americans of this area. I think the Duwamish in Chief Seattle, they would talk about how their actions will affect the next seven generations. You know, how does this action that we're choosing to do right now, how does it affect seven generations in the future? And that's really holding this quality of non-harm and also generosity of how can we support and make the world a better place for those unseen, unborn generations. Now, non-stealing is often rephrased as this freely offered. You know, is it freely offered? And is it truly offered in a free way? Maybe because no one's actually asked, you said you could take it, you know, it's better to assume not. If you ever go on a retreat, you see there's often these words, dana. You know, dana meaning generosity or act of giving. And when you see something that's said dana, that means, okay, that's freely offered. You can take of it. And if you didn't know that, you think, who's this person, Donna, who has all these signs everywhere? And that freely offered quality. The first retreat I went on, and when I first encountered this teaching around the precepts and this one about non-stealing, I could just feel something relaxed in me. I felt like I didn't have to guard and protect my possessions in the same way I normally did. That I could trust the people around me to have some integrity, to have a sense of honoring my own possessions. And so this is one of those ones, it's nice to play with if no one knows whether you do something or not. How are you when no one's watching? How are you when it's a complete vacuum? And we'll get to this in a couple of minutes here, but it's really whether it's coming from this external motivation. Like if someone's watching me, then I'm going to be more ethical versus it doesn't matter if someone's watching or not because it's coming from an internal place, my internal motivation. And the final one is of non-sexual misconduct, non-sexual harm. Now, this is a very rich one to kind of explore and dive into. Of course, there's the obvious ways of not disrupting and establish relationship or couple, or you know, not messing with someone who's already in relationship, to have a you know, sense of respecting the age difference. We can also look at the more subtle aspects, you know, around you know what's really true consent with a partner. You know, can you have that true consent, that true that they can actually are in a place that they can say yes. Often when there's a power differential, like a teacher and a student, or you know, minister and a clergy, what's it called? What are they called? The other people? The
laity.
The laity, there you go, the laity. Whenever there's that boss and an employee, that kind of power differential, it can sometimes be hard to say no, to really honor that. Or if there's intoxication or there's a sense of confusion, to honor that, to be very conscious of that. And of course, you know, being sexual is one of those things which is, it's a delight of being human. And it helps us, you know, have more humans around. And it's also a place of tremendous harm, of impact. There's so many people who have experienced sexual assault, sexual abuse. And to realize that, that may be, that's part of the energy that's out there. So having an extra level of integrity around it. Even how we meet and hold people, can we see them as a whole person instead of like just the sexual aspects of them? See them as in a sense of integrity. So these three aspects of non-killing, of non-stealing, and non-sexual harm, the question as practitioners is what do we do when that energy arises to kind of push against one of those precepts in a big way or a small way? This is part of being human. Now, if you go the route of trying to repress it or kind of deny that it's there, then, you know, Kabir's poem speaks to that, that we repress one thing and it comes out a different direction. We stop that and it comes out a different direction. Right? But if instead we turn toward what's driving that, what's underneath that movement, often unethical behavior is often driven by something. It was often driven by perhaps a sense of lack, a sense of hunger, a sense of inadequacy, or a sense of hurt. And noticing the impulse, you know, going back to that why is it, the intention, what's the intention that's driving it? Can I pause and see what's behind that? Maybe I'm feeling hurt and I want to lash out, feeling scared, I want to hurt someone. You know, noticing that, can I attend to that hurt in a more pure, kind, direct way? Can I have compassion toward that hurt? Perhaps there's a sense of inner lack, a sense of loneliness, a sense of something's fundamentally wrong with me and I want to fill that either through taking things or through my sexual activity to turn toward that lack itself. Can I meet that in a deeper way? Can I honor that and feel it and open to it? So this way, we can use wise action, you know, there's kind of two ways we can use it. One is a set of like boundaries that we kind of keep ourselves down that rail, like, not quite like bowling, but you know, the bowling and you put those bumpers up and keeps you out of the gutter. It kind of keeps you going the right direction. You feel yourself bump up against it in small ways or big ways. You use that as a chance of learning. Hopefully you start to realize you're getting close to it before you actually hit that boundary, actually go across that line. But sometimes we do it after the fact. It's like, oh wow, I took that without even thinking. I just grabbed that extra cookie or that thing that I thought no one would notice. Right? So then I have a chance to reflect and to grow from that. As our practice matures and deepens, we become more inwardly sensitive. We can start to feel that movement toward those boundaries. We can notice it in more and more subtle ways, even to the point that the mind just goes there a little bit and we don't put more energy to it. We don't keep following it. And we can learn to turn more and more deeply into what's actually here, what's underneath. Part of this sense of working with wise action and the precepts in general in this way is we cross that line and we learn from it. We become more and more sensitive to it. And we also start to see the harm that's caused by that. We actually take it in. Sometimes this is one of the strongest ways to help us learn to become more ethical, is by understanding the harm that's caused by us by not being ethical, to really take it in. To really take it in a personal way, that when I did this action, I can really see the harm without being defended or pushing it away, but really receive it and know it. In this way, it starts to give us more motivation. We can also start to see how each of these movements can represent those unwholesome roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. And in essence, in an essential way, when we act from those, we're actually causing harm to ourselves. There's an inward harm that also arises. So we become more and more aware of that in a direct, immediate way. There's one sutta where the Buddha spoke of the precepts, and following them is a boundless quality of benefit, boundless toward all beings and boundless toward ourselves. So this is the moving, we feel ourselves moving against it. The other way we can work with these is it starts to become more of this, just a kind of a positive, proactive way we are in the world. That we proactively are more generous. We're proactively care for others. We have more of a sense of holding people in their integrity, in their wholeness. We have a sense of really cherishing life, nurturing life, allowing life to flourish and deepen. And so it starts to be this expression of our practice. We start to be, that's a way that we live the practice. And this becomes this beautiful integration of what we're learning in our practice and how we come into the world. And so I so much appreciate this Eightfold Path, that sometimes we can look at the Dharma practice as something that we kind of do on the side as a philosophy, as an understanding. But the Buddha said, no, you have to look at how you act in the world. That can't be left out. It really matters how we act, how we use our bodies, how we use our minds, how we are with ourselves. All right, just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. All right, thank you for your kind attention. All right, so let's get started with our groups. So we'll do small groups of 4 to 5 people, both online and here in person. And the topic is going to be around this wise action. So it's good to just remember the guidelines of confidentiality and whatever is said in those groups to keep them just within those groups. So not to repeat that or not to say this person said something, you know, such and such. So that way we can relax and we can share more honestly. These really are about sharing your own understanding, your own journey. It's not about giving suggestions or advice to each other, but just to really listen deeply and to share from your own experience. So really the question from the homework last week was to find, when we find ourselves pushing against some aspect of wise action, so maybe there's a killing side of it, the stealing side, or the sexual misconduct side of it, have you noticed the suffering that's underneath that? The suffering that's driving that action or the impulse to act in that way? And can we turn toward that with compassion? Can there be some level of compassion around it? And does that open up the room for wise action to emerge? Right? So you can pick any one of those and just kind of play with how the edges are. How do you work with those edges within yourself and others? And if, you know, these three don't, you know, you don't resonate as much, you can always go back to wise speech. And I'm sure that's a rich one. Right? Does that make sense? Right? So about 20 minutes for this group dialogue. And keep track of your time. I'll give you a 5-minute warning to come back. All right, welcome back. So we have a chance now for any questions or sharing you might have. And online, you can just raise your virtual hand and I'll call on you. Here in the room, you can raise your physical hand and Ken will bring the mic around.
Is this, all right, this is good. I shared this in the Sunday morning sit, and I think folks found it useful, so I'll share it here too. But I recently went on a retreat with a couple of ex-monastics, Willa Tanya Reed and Elizabeth Day. And on retreat, the question that they kept asking each day and throughout the day was, what would love do? And that has been so instructive for me with wise action, but also with wise intention and how I sit. And I find that that's so useful. And, you know, what's leading to liberation? What's leading to suffering? So yeah. What would love do?
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think it's really skillful sometimes to find, you know, like a word like that, that can really capture, kind of take care of, you know, kind of really get us going the right direction, not both with in terms of the ethical side of things, but also in terms of the liberation side. Yeah, what would love do? Yeah, that goes along, that covers basically everything. Yeah, because sometimes it's hard to track, okay, which of the Eightfold Path am I working on now and which are the precepts? And it can get, you know, we kind of get in our heads, but we go, okay, it's really ultimately comes down to, you know, coming, leading with our heart. What would love do? Yeah, beautiful. Thank you. All right, go ahead, Andrea.
So I guess maybe this previous comment kind of answers my comment. It seems like right action includes a lot more than just refraining from killing, refraining from stealing, and being sexually thoughtful. It seems like it can include thinking well about others and, like she said, what would love do, you know, is that true? I mean, it just seemed like those three things were a little limiting in mind.
Well, it's like it's a fairly clear, you know, bar there, or, you know, boundary. Okay, where are these, each of these three, but each one of them has a lot of nuances around it. that we can, you know, really go into. And I think especially as our practice deepens and we become more established in the practice, we start to play with those kind of subtle aspects. You know, what's the subtle quality of really, you know, wise action in this moment? And, you know, breathing life into it, something like, okay, what would love do, really shapes it, you know, goes to that proactive quality of expression. So we're not just trying to keep ourselves in that straight and narrow, but we're actually trying to breathe life and breathe energy into this positive way of being in the world, you know, based in kindness, based in love, based in generosity, based in, you know, care and consideration for other people. And there's so many subtle ways that can show up. You know, subtle ways we can, you know, in a grocery line, you know, maybe we let someone go ahead of us, or that sense of consideration, that sense of interconnection, that could be another way. What's an interconnected way of being in this moment? You know, how can I relate, be with this person, be with this action within relationship of interconnection versus separation and isolation?
Oh, isn't that wise action then?
That's wise action, yes. Yeah, you're welcome. Yeah, it's a rich practice, you know, because there's the ways we can, you know, act from that place. And there's also the learning that comes when our impulses are opposite of that. When we feel that harshness, we can go into, remember the Buddha talked about, you know, teaching one thing, suffering and the end of suffering. And so sometimes really understanding the nature of dukkha, understanding the cause of it, understanding, you know, both from the Buddhist perspective, the psychological perspective, all these ways we can see how this impulse of wanting to act in an unkind way or a way that's based in harm reveals that. And so that's one of the great things of being lay practitioners. We get to see, we have lots of opportunities for that. All right, what else is out there in the room? All right, we have two hands came simultaneously. Yeah, let's just go down that way and then.
I've been thinking about non-action as action. Like something that wise action can be not doing the thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not pulling down the political sign that you don't like. Just like wise speech can be silence. Just been thinking about that a lot.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, so sometimes the right action is one of not following that impulse, of non-doing. Because it's almost like we see that impulse to go one way versus the other, and we start to become more clear. This way leads to more suffering. This leads to more isolation. This leads to more kindness, even if we disagree with something like the political sign. Yeah, Romilly?
Hi.
Hello.
So I've been playing with love and wisdom. And so when someone said, what would love do in this moment? Because I have this tendency to sort of give beyond what I have or... just like and so what is, like, can you talk to wisdom and love, or like, are they one and the same, like, you know, different sides of the same coin?
Love and wisdom, and particularly around kind of over giving, not taking care of yourself or putting others first.
Yeah, it's wise action, right? This time we're talking about wise action, but it's just a general overarching question that I've been having lately.
Yeah, love and wisdom. Sometimes we talk about the two wings of the Dharma, compassion and wisdom. And, you know, love can be an expression of compassion, or compassion can be an aspect of love. So those kind of, you know, there's a kind of a big umbrella, or, you know, quality of that, whether it's love or compassion or sympathetic joy. But it's basically, you know, in one way there, like we tend to have, sometimes we have a bias toward one or the other, like maybe we're drawn to the wisdom, maybe we're drawn more to the compassion, but ultimately we learn to bring a sense of balance between those two. We start to see that they really are one and the same, that the wisdom has to be there for love to really be coming from a wise place. Right, versus a enmeshed place or a codependent place or a enabling place or a place of self-sacrifice. All those have, you know, wisdom component isn't quite so developed in it. But at the same time with wisdom, I could be like, okay, you know, someone's dying and I say, well, that's just life. You know, we're all going to die. There's a coldness and an aloofness to that. So that needs to have compassion kind of breathe into that wisdom to really see the personal. Sometimes I think of it, reframe it as the personal versus the universal, that we have to be able to go to both of those elements, have to be able to feel the very deep personalness of it and also have a relationship to the universal nature of it, emptiness and form. You know, those things come together. And life often gives us that feedback, right? If we give too much at our own expense, and we feel exhausted, or that people have resentment, or I feel resentment, then, you know, maybe wisdom needs to kind of come into that sense of love. Or if my wisdom is kind of, I'm telling people my truth about them, you know, that's not the compassion needs to come into that also to see the humanness, see the diversity of being human. Does that help a little bit, or not? Does that quite get to it?
Can you reframe my truth about them, like how I read them or what I see that is lacking in them? Is that what do you mean by that?
Yeah, sometimes we get really enamored with like wise speech and I want to just speak what's true. But I don't have the wisdom to see that maybe it's my opinion or my limited understanding. And I want to tell you, let me tell you what's true about you. Yeah. You know? And, you know, sometimes you talk about wise speech and truthfulness, and then there's all these arguments in the parking lot as the couples are telling each other these things. You know, you really snore a lot, or, you know, those kind of things. So it's a distortion of that, you know, because really what's really true, if we look at our thoughts around it, our ideas, our perception is often very limited and biased. Right, we have a one perspective, so we need to own that. Okay, that's my perspective, my limited understanding. Someone else may have a very different perspective on the same thing, and you know we don't really know what's going on in another person. We may have a sense of them, but it kind of asserting or pushing your truth on someone is usually not a good recipe for harmony or relationship. Anything else?
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, anyone else like to ask or share anything online or in person? All right, go ahead, Emery.
Hi. Hopefully my screen doesn't freeze. I've been having a little trouble, so if I freeze, I'm sorry. This isn't necessarily related to the topic, but I wanted to bring it up because it's just been so on my mind lately. Hmm. And gosh, it's hard for me to talk about without crying, but I've just been so touched and upset by what's happening in Gaza right now. Hmm. And it's just really been weighing on me, really been feeling it, and I feel so powerless to do anything about that suffering. And I've tried to be present with my own suffering and to experience it and to hold it spaciously and to tell myself that me neglecting my own, like part of me is like, I don't even want to be present with my suffering because it's not ending the suffering there. But then, you know, I'm like, well, that logic doesn't really play out. Like, it's important for me to work with this. But just any wisdom that you have or any advice you have about how we can respond wisely to something that's so sad.
Yeah, something that we have no control over, or almost no control over, and there's a helplessness around it. So the helplessness aside of it, you know, going into that just becomes overwhelming very quickly. Like, because you want to alleviate, you want to stop it, you want to fix it, and it seems like it's so easy, but the powers, you know, that are at play make it so hard to do that. So it's like, how do I hold the suffering, you know, that I'm experiencing around it? How do I have a sense of spaciousness and ease around it? At the same time, not turning away from it, not ignoring it, not becoming numb to it. And this is it's really this fine line. I mean, we can take, you know, that's a very profound and devastating example of this, you know, right now. But we all have, you know, maybe more personal. Some of us are dealing with chronic illness or maybe end of life issues. And there's this thing that I just can't change the fact that this is going to happen, or I can't change this issue. How do I still be with it? How do I hold that dukkha? You know, there's one thing that comes to mind is a quick poem by Rumi, something like someone is asking, how do I hold, you know, the suffering? My heart just seems so small. And the answer is, you know, your eyes are much smaller, but yet they can take in the whole world. Mm. And so it's like expanding the container, expanding that sense of what's holding it. And this is kind of this, you know, back to Romilly's question around, you know, love and wisdom. It's like when it becomes overwhelming, it's often the personal part is really too gripped, right? So bringing this universal quality to it, just, you know, realizing, well, this is part of the nature of life, that we all will experience death at some point. We all experience loss. We experience suffering, you know, even though it's needless and unnecessary in this standpoint, you know, how can I reflect on that in a way that makes it broad enough that something relaxes in us? I guess that's the question. Can I hold it a broad enough way that something starts to become easier? It's kind of a paradox, right? It seems like if I open too big, then I'll become overwhelmed. Like that poem, Kindness, that I like to read by Naomi Shihab Nye, is like, you know, seeing the size, you know, wake up with sorrow, open to the sorrow until the point you see the size of the cloth. You see how this suffering in Gaza is related to suffering throughout the world, throughout your life and the people around you. And something can loosen in that. It doesn't make it go away. It's not in magical thinking. And yet the capacity of the heart expands to hold that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
And, you know, offering those heartfelt metta, you know, may your suffering ease, may your suffering diminish. May there be food, may there be ease in your life. And you, even though it may not seem like it's ever going to happen, you just keep offering that.
Mm. Yeah, that does seem to be one thing that just feels like there's a felt sense of that being the right. It just feels right to do that. That's been really helpful.
Yes, in times when we can't feel like we have no control or no power, what do we have power and control over? Mm-hmm. Our own minds, our own intention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you for that question. And I hope you saw all the hearts that were floating up.
Thank you.
All right, any other questions or sharing? Yes.
Let's see, I guess along the idea of wisdom and compassion, the two sides of wisdom and compassion, I guess sometimes I have difficulty with balancing those things, like practicing with compassion. Let's see, I'll use an example of like in the place that I work, there's a person who can sometimes respond a little bit snappy. They can be a little bit difficult to work around. If you're working with them on a project and, you know, you're trying to be collaborative and you give feedback to kind of be able to work together, that sometimes they'll take it as an insult. And my kind of response is to like try and have compassion with that and understanding that it's coming from a place of suffering. And then working with that will kind of almost make me want to like help them or like respond in a way that's like, you know, productive, wise speech, helpful, kind of try and resolve this in a way. But sometimes like it's not possible, like, you know, essentially like it's not my work to do really.
Right.
And it's hard for me to find that line that like, this isn't my work to do. And at what point do I like, okay, I'm not going to be around them then.
Yeah.
I'm not going to work with them. That it's hard for me to like find, like pick between those two things, if that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. There's a lot of kind of intersections and overlap of, you know, these topics, right? And so as you're talking, one that comes to mind is just the idea of what healthy boundaries are. What's it like to have that sense of integrity? Because for most of us, our boundaries, sense of boundaries, is really distorted. You know, maybe we were not taught it, or maybe we had abuse or, you know, violations that made those boundaries really kind of bented in. But, there, you know, I think ultimately there's a pathway of just becoming, feeling that sense of wholeness, that sense of integrity. And then it's like, okay, this, how can I work with this person? But realizing that, yeah, there's, it takes two people. It's like, you can't do, you know, if each person has to do 50%, you can't do, if they're not doing 50%, it's like, okay, well then, I guess we won't get this job done, or I'll go someplace else. You know, so it's like when we go into doing that 60 or 70%, there's this, when I was doing therapy, there's this boundary exercise we did that you stand, like sitting next to another person, and you do like, okay, this is me and this is you. And you kind of get a physical sense of that space. And then you would play with the different lines, like, okay, now you be like my mother or dad, and okay, this is you, you know, and you can get a visceral feel for how that is. And so you kind of learn, okay, this is where I am, right? So then that's really integration of that wisdom and compassion. You know, find where that is. Cause it's sometimes we over-err, or maybe we become too boundaried or too, you know, too cold. Like, no, that's your stuff. You know, and sometimes there's a time to be connected. And that's that listening is even though this person, you have a history, you know, we all kind of formed a picture around them based on your interaction. Each day, it's a fresh day. You never know when there might be this ripeness or this capacity to meet them in a way they're able to receive that compassion.
Yeah. That's it. I like that. That's a nice way to put it. Maybe some days are the days where I keep away from them, and some days are the days maybe I could.
That's right. Yeah.
Be beneficial.
And you know, you're not, of course, one way the whole every day. Some days you're tired. Some days you're cranky.
Yeah.
Some days you feel really a lot of capacity. And I mean, anyone who's a parent knows this too. You know, it's like you have to kind of dance that line there. But yeah, it's try to make each day a fresh one. And at the same time, understand, okay, this is what it feels like. This is where my space is and where my space ends.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Maybe one more if there's anyone. Yeah, in the back. All right, there in the back. There you go.
Hi. I was wondering if you have any thoughts about family dynamics, especially like really ingrained patterns, especially with maybe like much younger like family members or much older family members who, you know, don't are not aware of these languages. So then, one person can one person really change everything in a family? And yeah, and what happens, you know, when it's like the patterns are so ingrained?
Yeah, it's a real it's a question that many people come up against. You know, I think there's some system dynamic theories that if one thing changes, the system tries to make that thing change back to fit. You know, so it's like everything, okay, this is your place. And you start to change that, the system, whether it's your older, younger siblings, your parents, they try to push you back. So it can be a lot of inertia to try to do that. And so it's partly, it's like learning to kind of do that inner transformation yourself. It's like, okay, maybe I can't change this external system or the system of my family dynamics the way I would like to, but I can take care of my own part in it. I can become more clear. And I've seen this with myself, I was just talking to my wife about this with my brothers, that I used to kind of have this kind of teasing way of interacting with them, you know, and, you know, she said, you know, look at that a little bit. And I just don't do that in the same way anymore. There's a different way of relating. And partly, you know, to say to do that, it's not like you just stop it. You have to do a lot of internal work about what motivates that. How do I connect? So you kind of get more and more clear about your own power to it, how this one part fits. And what that does, it makes it so the system is no longer so rigid in you that you have more flexibility. And when you start to be more flexible, sometimes you can throw little things in, you know, do things a little bit differently, and the system kind of like, whoa, well, that's maybe not so bad. And it starts to shift slowly over time. So eventually, you know, the system can start to change. And it might be, you know, you just work with one sibling or one parent, one at a time, and kind of, you know, change the dynamic. Like Thanksgiving dinner is probably not the great time to do this, right? You know, do it when you're going for a walk in a place that's neutral, that's not near the home, and, you know, different dynamics. And sometimes you can be surprised because often these systems do have, you know, they have the way they were there developed, but they also have a lot of pain with them. And people want to have more ease, you know. So noticing is that what would love do? That's a great, great way to find, you know, it's a simple handle that allows you to find your way through that. But it's no magic pills there for you. But it's very worth doing. All right. Thank you all for your questions and engagement. This is, you know, such an essential part of our practice, that sense of integrity around how we act in the world, using our wisdom to help support that, compassion to help support that, and our mindfulness practice makes us be able to see very clearly, you know, more and more clearly. Okay, I wish you well, and you're welcome to chat with each other and say goodbye, and thank you all for those online. May you be well.